Jared Diamond, the general question is still whether our world is tearing itself apart faster than it's knitting itself together in this age of globalization. You're the man who's taught a lot of people to see ourselves in a 13,000-year time span since the last ice age. You told us roughly how we got here, but remind us, where are we?
Well, one way to express where we are would be in what could be the final countdown. What one can say for sure is that within the next 50 years, lots of important things are going to get settled in one way or another, settled either in pleasant ways of our own choice or in unpleasant ways not of our choice. And one can tick off the list of such things. They're familiar. Loss of fresh water supplies, fossil fuels, biodiversity, forests, fisheries, accumulations of toxics, introduced pests, and all of these things are changing at a rate such that we will either solve them ourselves within the next 50 years or they will solve themselves for us. And so that's where we're going. The next 50 years are the countdown.
Well, let's talk about them, and I'd love you to sort of prioritize the list. You know, you didn't mention sort of mass poverty. You did mention climate change, in effect, pandemic diseases, war, rumors of war. I mean, set today's crises in the context of the very long Jared Diamond view.
Sure. Today's crises, you asked at the beginning, could I prioritize them? And I think my prioritization would be to say the most important priority is not to prioritize them. By that, I mean that there are a dozen things, all of which we have to solve, and if we fail to solve any one of them, we'll be done in. For example, climate change. Suppose we solve all our other problems like toxic waste and biodiversity and forests and so on, but fail to solve climate change and the world heats up by 10 degrees centigrade over the next half century and sea level rises and the ice caps melt, et cetera, et cetera. Even if we've solved everything else, global warming could do us in. So that's why I say to prioritize, we've got to avoid prioritizing and solve all our problems.
Well, where should we begin?
I could use a metaphor there. People sometimes ask, what's the most important thing in a marriage? And my answer would be the most important thing in a marriage is not to look for the single most important thing in a marriage because a happy marriage requires getting 37 things right. And if you got everything else right, but you argue about money, or if you got everything else right, but you disagree about the children or sex or religion, that one thing will do you in. So with marriage, you got to get it all right. That's right. And similarly with our world today.
What do you see as working in the right direction? And I'm eager to just ask you the internet question. I mean, on a scale with bronze or the invention of steel or invention of literacy. Where do you put this new machine of kind of instant world communication?
New machine lets us do faster and more extensively things we've been doing for the last 10,000 years. Is it a positive force or negative force? Well, like many things, often one hears the question, is this going to be good? And it's like knowledge, power, technology generally. Is technology good or bad? Technology is morally neutral. The internet is morally neutral. Over the internet, you can send messages telling one group of people to bomb buildings in the land of another group of people. Or over the internet, you can also send information about increasing agricultural productivity. So the internet ups the stakes and it increases the rate at which everything is changing.
Do you believe that sort of point-to-point conversation, connection, is in itself a promising thing or not?
Again, I would say it's morally neutral. Point-to-point conversation between Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants is not something that's good for the whole world. Point-to-point conversation, say, between presidents of two large countries that would otherwise be ready to launch missiles at each other would be a useful technology. More generally, I could say that one looks at lots of things going on around the world and one can get pessimistic when you see the rate of increase of our impact on the world and the proliferation of our problems. But I think the single most hopeful sign is related to the internet. That's to say, it's the increase of knowledge, the increase of global knowledge, and the increase of past knowledge. Mm. So, for example, today we turn on our TV sets, or we turn on our computers, and we see what's happening in Somalia and Afghanistan. So we're not ignorant about the problems happening elsewhere in the world. Whereas any time in the past when societies got into trouble, for example, when here in the U.S. Southwest, the Anasazi Society of Native Americans began to collapse in the 1100s. The poor Anasazi had no way of turning on their TV set and seeing that Easter Islanders were getting into problems, and they didn't have their archaeologists to trot out the books and show them that Mycenaean Greece has already collapsed. Mm. Whereas today, between the internet and television and radio and all the other media, the big thing going in our favor, despite all the other things going against us, the big thing in our favor is knowledge of distant places and knowledge of past times, so that we're the first society in world history that has the possibility of learning from wide experience.
Hmm. Jerry Diamond, you draw a rather dire assignment here. We've got maybe 50 years to get all the answers right in a row. Before we get back to that, I'd like your account of how we get to this polarization. Poverty, an important one, but the fundamentalisms of the world, the general air of hostility, if not doom, in the world today.
How did we get to where we are? Well, I suppose since my book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, summarized everything about everybody for the last 13,000 years in, 420 pages, I can also summarize for you in a couple of sentences how we got to where we are today. How did we get to where we are today? If by that you mean what appear to be the accelerating problems in the world, terrorism, gap between rich and poor, nuclear proliferation, and so on,
right.
Perhaps a magic word there would be acceleration. Namely, that over the last 13,000 years, change has been coming faster and faster and faster. For example, my father was born in 1902, and I grew up using the word icebox. We had a refrigerator at home, but I called it an icebox because my parents had an actual icebox with ice that you put into it. My father grew up with an icebox. Mm. I grew up not with an icebox, but with a refrigerator. So that's a change in the last, 100 years? Similarly, telephone has proliferated during that time. But if you go back 5,000 years into the past, the differences between 5100 BC and 5000 BC were rather modest compared to the changes today. So things are changing faster and faster. There's also what can be called compound interest, namely like interest on your banking accounts. Hmm. If in your bank you have $1 million with compound interest, even with today's low interest rates, at the end of a year with your $1 million, you may have earned an extra $15,000. If in your bank account, like my son's, you have $100, then at the end of the year, you have earned $1.50. In short, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And that's part of what's going on in the world today, that despite the internet and global communication, the rich, including the rich countries, have an enormous head start, and they're pulling faster ahead rather than the gap narrowing.
I keep wondering, rereading Guns, Germs, and Steel, about the place of geography in the world today. In an era of, jet travel, satellite television, internet messages at the speed of light, you wouldn't think geography should be as divisive as it was. How important is it still, and why?
Yeah, you might think that geography is vanishing in importance because the internet can make connections north-south just as easily east-west, and I have daily correspondence with my colleagues in Australia and New Guinea and other places. So does geography still matter? A short answer would be I am in the process of voting with my feet. I'm in the process of transferring my academic affiliation into the geography department here at UCLA. Hmm. Yes, geography really does matter. When I was growing up, when I was about to go to college, colleges were in the process of abolishing their geography departments because they had the idea that geography is a matter of memorizing state capitals, something of no importance. But today, despite the internet, geography really matters. Why does it matter? Number of reasons. To take a banal example, Anopheles mosquitoes of genus Anopheles, which carry malaria, live in only certain climates. They don't live north of the Arctic Circle. They live in warm climates. And therefore, if, like my New Guinea friends, you are in an area where Anopheles mosquitoes are endemic, then you are very likely to contract malaria. Whereas if you live in Minnesota or Winnipeg, for sure you're not going to contract malaria unless you go to warm places. There's one example. Second example, banal example, is parasites. There's a saying that the most valuable public health measure in the world is a cold winter. And what that means is that you don't get many parasites, parasitic worms and other parasites, in cold climates because the parasites die in the winter. Whereas in the tropics, in Indonesia, my Indonesian friends on the average carry six parasites, that are infected by six parasites at any one time. There's something bound to geography. Or another thing bound to geography, agricultural productivity varies considerably between the temperate zones and the tropics. On the average, agricultural productivity is higher in the temperate zones than in the tropics for a number of reasons, including soil, nutrients in soil, winters, etc. And then the last reason geography matters is something we can get into in more detail, an outcome of guns, germs, and steel, namely the heavy hand of history, that some places have been favored geographically, and they've been favored for 10,000 years. That's a huge head start to catch up with. So, in short, geography now is more important than ever, and all you universities that abolished your geography departments, repent and correct your error.
Okay. The heavy hand of history fascinates me. You write a lot in the book about the transition from hunter-gathering societies to agricultural societies, from tribal societies on the move to settled communities that had livestock and crops and whatnot. It seems an obvious choice, and yet it took thousands of years in some places. And by extension, you know, we're still going through this very slow change in the world of what we Americans love to think of as progress. And again, it's related to a sort of persistence of geographical patterns. African agricultural cultivation is still very, very different from ours. But in so many places, you'd think, why haven't they caught on? Why haven't they adopted our way? Why aren't they living in, tract housing or high rises like us, etc.? Explain that heavy hand of history. Why, in a certain sense, things move amazingly slowly, and in our world today, they seem to be moving in the wrong direction. I mean, there's more poverty, more polarization of wealth, resources, and even feeling than we can deal with.
A glib, incomplete answer as to why they, meaning those hunter-gatherers and poor people out there, are not moving rapidly in our direction. A glib answer would be, they're smart and we're not.
Maybe they know what they want.
Exactly. They know that they've got a good thing. That's an exaggeration. But the fact is that the transition from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle to agriculture throughout history generally was associated with a decrease in wealth and an increase in work and a shortening of lifespan. In addition, hunter-gatherers, there are some left in the world today. Some of my New Guinea friends have been grew up partly as hunter-gatherers. Mm. Hunter-gatherers love the hunter-gatherer lifestyle for good reasons. It's really a rich and rewarding lifestyle with a good deal of freedom to it. And when hunter-gatherers see what farmers are doing, they despise what farmers are doing. It's not in their values to go out there and do the backbreaking work with a hoe. So one can say the hunter-gatherers are smart. Now, one can come back and say, Jared Diamond, you're exaggerating. What are you doing living in Los Angeles, eating food from supermarkets? If you think the hunter-gatherer lifestyle is so great, why didn't you go back to the Sepik River in New Guinea? And the fact is that there are real advantages to the Los Angeles supermarket lifestyle. I like to read and write rather than go out and hunt for kangaroos or forage for roots every day. Mm. And I like to be healthy. I will probably have a longer life well, I've already achieved a longer life than the average hunter-gatherer. So there are big advantages to living in modern society, but there are enormous disadvantages, including the social disadvantages that you mention. And hunter-gatherers know about it, and that's part of the reason why, with much intelligence, they cling to their lifestyle.
Well, that's the hunter-gatherer thing, past, but put it in the context of today and this very puzzling to a lot of us resistance to modernization and westernization. I mean, what if there's some deep logic in the resistance that we're not grasping? I mean, and it's not that they hate freedom, as President Bush says, but maybe see Western civilization as a wholly nasty piece of work and would prefer their own.
Western civilization isn't a wholly nasty piece of work, but it's a mixed bag. Let me point out a couple of examples of that mixed bag, of the downside of the mixed bag that we sitting here in Los Angeles and Boston tend not to think about: the health consequences and the social consequences. In the first world today, in modern America, friendships and social connections and relations between the generations are strained and, to put it mildly, unhappy compared to village societies. Mm. In village societies in New Guinea, you've got your friends around you. You grow up with them. Those friends will be with you for your life. And when you grow old, you're not going to be put into an old people's home and maybe you get a visit every Sunday, or maybe you don't, but you'll be living in the village with your relatives and your friends, and you'll be taken care of by them. I remember my first visit to Fiji. I was talking with a Fijian who happened to be a Fijian minister, and we were talking about what's it like in Fiji and what's it like in the United States, and he burst out and said, "You people in the United States, you throw away your old people." Hmm. "And here in Fiji, we take care of them in the villages." Okay, that is one. It's not just the care of old people, but it's the paucity of friendships and the fragileness of social relationships in general in the first world compared to village societies. That's one thing that they look at and don't like. That's one example. Mm. The other thing that I mentioned is health-wise. It is true that on the average our lifespans are longer. In the United States, average lifespan is in the 70s or 80s, whereas in traditional human societies it was in the 40s and 50s. But nevertheless, we are acquiring some very bad things from a health point of view, effects of our lifestyle, affluent lifestyle with lots of food and with not much exercise. A prime example is diabetes, so-called adult onset or type 2 diabetes, which is undergoing an explosion around the world. In Europe, that explosion already happened in the past, so the people who were genetically susceptible to diabetes, lots of them died off in the past. That's not to say there still isn't diabetes in Europe and among white Americans. There is. But where there's a real explosion today is in China and India and in the developing world. At the rate we're going now, within 20 years, there'll be about 500 million people with diabetes in China and India and other countries that are currently third world. And that's all because they are striving for the first world lifestyle and diet, and lots of them will achieve it, and they will come down with diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and lots of other nasty conditions. In traditional New Guinea, I've never seen a fat person, not a single one, never seen anyone overweight, and diabetes and hypertension are unknown until New Guineans start moving to the cities.
Probably never seen anybody on an exercise bicycle either.
That's right. But all New Guineans look like what we call the lean body mass. They're really muscular. They'll trot for 15 or 20 miles a day with a 40 to 80-pound pack, and then they put down the pack and they do it the next day. They don't need an they are their own exercise bike.
Jared Diamond, I wish you'd just sort of take a long look back. I mean, stand back and look at this sort of us and them world, and sort through the evidence of convergence on one hand and polarization on the other. And there are two very general notions that are sort of popular out there. One, the sort of end of history idea that everybody in the world really wants to live in New Jersey or California, wants the Western model of social democracy and market capitalism with a certain safety net. And on the other hand, there's the clash of civilizations idea that we're in for a mega confrontation between the West and the rest, that the next big wars will be about civilizational identities, not ideology or economics or iron ore or anything else. What is the deeper trend, as you see it, between convergence and divergence?
The deeper trend would be convergence and divergence. That's to say, both of them are going on. Examples of convergence. You mentioned everyone wants to live in California. Well, there are plenty of people, including lots of Bostonians, who wouldn't be caught dead living in California. But what people do want to do all over the world is to have certain material benefits of first world civilization. For example, my second year in New Guinea, I had some New Guineans who had been working with me for the summer, and at the end of the summer I paid them. And I was curious to see what they would do with the money that I had paid them. And the first thing they did was they went out and bought umbrellas. Now, that's understandable, because in New Guinea, in the parts of New Guinea where I work, it rains between 200 and 900 inches of rain per year. So it's very useful to have an umbrella. And an umbrella is more convenient than some big banana leaves. New Guineans and people all around the world also want Coca-Cola and McDonald's. So there are some practical things that they want. That's an example of convergence. One can say it's a superficial convergence, but there's also deeper convergence of wanting the means for wealth and wanting television, certainly wanting to read. As for clash of civilizations, the West versus the rest, it's not so much the West versus the rest, but there are multiple constituencies today. Mm. One constituency would be the First World. Most of the First World is the rest, but Japan is also part of the First World, and Japan has its cameras and its other attributes of Western civilization. But the Japanese still have the Japanese language and Japanese writing, and they have their kanji, and I don't see Japanese culture as converging on American culture during future decades. So there's the First World, which itself is diverse. One can say, the First World versus the Third World, all of those poor countries. But with the internet and globalization now, those poor countries which in the past we used to ignore, we can no longer ignore. Hmm. For example, 20 years ago, suppose 20 years ago you had asked some world strategist, some advisor to the president, suppose you had asked Henry Kissinger, what are the name two countries in the world that are utterly irrelevant to American interests? 20 years ago, someone would say, well, that's pretty easy. I would start with Somalia and Afghanistan. Why? Because they're landlocked, they're really poor, they're of no geopolitical significance whatsoever. But we've seen within the last decade that Somalia and Afghanistan are important. And the reason they're important is that globalization, which we tend to think of as us sending them our good things, like the internet and Coca-Cola. Globalization has just improved communication. It can go in either direction. So globalization also means them sending us their bad things, which include germs and terrorism and other things like that. That's why today we have to be concerned about all countries. And so going back to your question about clash of civilizations, it doesn't line up into neat teams. The First World is diverse. Within the developing world, there are countries that are practically into the First World today, like Singapore and Malaysia and Taiwan and Hong Kong and Mauritius have practically made it within the last couple of decades. Mm. And then there are other countries that are getting poorer and poorer, such as Mali and Zambia, maybe El Salvador, maybe Paraguay. The world is a diverse place.
I want to come back to some of those countries and questions of development, why they're getting richer or poorer. I want to get your theory about it. But I also want to just draw you out on a basic point in Guns, Germs, and Steel. The book is explicitly anti-racist in the sense that the differences in our fates and in our societies, you argue, with infinite detail, the differences are not in the brains or the bodies of the human species, but in their location and their crops and their agriculture and their diseases and whatnot. I wanted to ask you, I mean, how sure are you that it's all one brain inside that human species everywhere?
Well, while it's conceivable that it might turn out that there are specialized differences in the brain, just as there are specialized differences in blood chemistry, like resistance to malaria or a lack of resistance to malaria, maybe it will turn out that some human populations, for genetic reasons, have better third-dimensional sense than do other human populations. No evidence for it whatsoever, but maybe it'll turn up. That's the most that I would expect. When people talk about racial differences, what they're really thinking of is not whether some people have better three-dimensional vision than others, but they're really thinking, do some people have genetically higher IQ than others? And in particular, the first world is the reason that the first world is rich today, is the reason that we white Americans and Europeans have smarter brains and genetically we are more gifted than those other people out there. There are two things that I would say to that. One is that we've now had about a century of racist psychologists. And by that, I'm not saying that all psychologists are racist. I'm saying that among those psychologists, those particular ones who are racist, have devoted much of their effort over the last century to trying to come up with convincing evidence that some people are genetically disadvantaged. And despite a century of effort, they haven't come up with evidence that's convinced many people.
Well,
that's one thing.
They're still trying. I mean, they're still measuring, you know, the size of cranial cavities and all sorts of things to prove a difference. I wonder, do you think that is the test worth the effort? Should those rumors of or intuitions of difference still be the object of scientific search?
I don't think it's worth the effort. I would say we already know enough, more than enough, to convince ourselves that there are not big average differences in intelligence among the world's populations, and that as far as practical consequences are concerned, we know enough that to show ourselves that every human population will profit by education. For example, again, my favorite working place of New Guinea, quite a few of my New Guinea friends were born in the Stone Age. They were born using stone tools. They were born into villages where there was no writing. And these same friends, government arrived, and so they are sent to school, and they learn to write. And they learned to operate computers, which is something that I haven't learned to do. And they learned how to send message by the internet, which is something I haven't learned to do. And then they learned how to pilot jet airplanes, which, again, I haven't learned to do. The point is that someone who's born in the Stone Age can nevertheless learn how to do the most modern things of the modern age, proving that educatability is worthwhile. The other thing I would say, and of all the things that I wrote in Guns, Germs, and Steel, the page that has made people the angriest is that in the prologue, I knew that in writing a book about world history, lots of people would immediately think, well, we know the answer to world history. It's that those people out there, those non-whites, are genetically disadvantaged. So if you don't discuss this right at the beginning, we're not even going to read the book. So at the beginning of the book, in order to convince people that it was worth reading the book and that the answer was not racial differences in IQ, I related my own experiences in New Guinea. My impressions in New Guinea, which I can't quantitate, are that on the average, New Guineans are slightly smarter than Europeans and Americans and Japanese, and I can see good reasons why they would end up slightly smarter. One is developmental. They grow up, New Guinea children grow up being actively stimulated. They're not sitting down passively in front of TV sets and video games, but they're talking, they're jabbering away to each other. And one thing that all psychologists agree on is that the important role of stimulation in childhood. If you're not stimulated in childhood, then you don't catch up later. New Guineans get lots of stimulation. That's not genetic, that's developmental. But there are also genetic reasons why you might expect people in modern societies to have been under less selection for intelligence, namely that in modern societies, over the last 2,000 years, the real killers have been infectious diseases.
Yes.
Whether you lived depended not so much on whether you were smart, but whether you had the right blood groups to survive smallpox. whereas in traditional New Guinea, whether you lived depended upon whether you had the social skills and the intelligence to avoid starving and get killed off in a tribal raid. So those are the reasons why I think are behind my impression that New Guineans have both developmental and genetic advantages, but I can't prove it. All I can say is there's no evidence whatsoever for racial disadvantages of those people who are in the third world, and my own impression is that, if anything, they've got the advantage, not the disadvantage. Mm.
Your reading of massive amounts of evidence is that it's not about racial difference. And yet I also wonder, in the division of the world today and the political difference, how much does just plain racism, the attribution of racial differences, have to do with our division and our dilemma?
It's got something to do with it, and there are plenty of examples in recent history.
I'm thinking racism is applied to China, for example, as well as to Africa, say.
Sure. Yeah, racism applies to China. Racism is applied to Japan. The U.S. and Europe, there are plenty of racists here, but there are also plenty of racists in other countries. For example, my New Guinea friends, if you ask them, do you prefer blonde women? God, no, disgusting. I never saw anything so bad-looking as a blonde woman with pale hair. They don't think that blondes are stupid. They just think that they're ugly. And in Japan, racist views are socially acceptable, politically acceptable, to a degree that's difficult to conceive of in the United States today. We got plenty of racists, but they've learned that it's not polite to say so. Whereas I remember on my first visit to Japan, I was having an interview with a Japanese cabinet minister, and the subject of guns, germs, and steel came up. Why have some people become richer today than others? Why are Japanese richer than New Guineans? Mm-hmm. And I went through my explanations in terms of history, domestication, et cetera, et cetera. And the minister then said to me, aha, but you've left out an important thing, intelligence. And so I went back over my reasons why I thought intelligence was not the answer. I talked away for a couple of minutes. My interpreter translated into Japanese, and he said, very interesting, but I still think maybe intelligence. And so I responded a bit more, and I said, I'm giving a lecture this evening on this. And he said, very interesting. I will come to your lecture, and I'll tell my staff to come. Unfortunately, that afternoon there was a typhoon, and he couldn't come. This is simply an example. I'm not meaning to bash the Japanese about this. I'm just saying that in the United States, we're maybe a little 10 or 20 years, a little further along in recognizing that it's not nice to say these things in public. But in other countries, it's still okay to say them.
The old typhoon punishment. I want you to make the connection, sort of race, culture, to politics. What does culture have to do with all these divisions in the world today? I mean, if people can't blame race, they'll the next harbor is culture.
Well, okay. What one can do in terms of race and culture, and as long as we're going for the big things, you've got two of the big three. You've got race, you've got culture, so let's complete it. Religion. What about race, culture, and religion?
Right.
If we look around the world today, are race, culture, and religion the main fault lines, that's to say the lines along which people are fighting? Well, in the last few years, I've gotten more and more interested in the social sciences, and I've been talking a lot more with economists and people in political science. And one of the things that my friends have been telling me within the last few months is that there's a whole science of war. There are social scientists who study what are the conditions behind war and what are the conditions behind civil war. Civil war, we've tended to study one by one. I'm fascinated with the American Civil War, but there are people who assemble databases of 70 civil wars in the last couple of decades. What generalizations can we make about civil wars? Mm-hmm. I certainly assume that civil wars are most likely to break out in countries between people of different religions or language or ethnicities. And it's perfectly true that in the former Yugoslavia, the fighting broke out between Muslims and Catholics and Orthodox. But as far as language is concerned, the fiercest fighting in the former Yugoslavia was between the Croats and the Serbs, who speak dialects of the same language. So language is overrated as a source of a fault lines. Again, Somalia. Somalia linguistically is one of the most homogeneous countries in Africa. Most Somalians speak Somali, and yet it's the country in the world that has gone furthest along in collapsing and losing its state institutions. So people will seize on race and religion and sometimes culture, really ethnicity, to justify beating up other people. But I think that's just creativity. In our own American history, our worst civil war was not fought along racial or religious or cultural fault lines, but or ethnic fault lines, but good old geographic and economic fault lines.
Ever to be that way, do you think? Are those the fault lines forever or not? Economics.
There can be all sorts of fault lines. Again, looking at this science of civil war, economics plays a large role in civil wars and state collapses. I mentioned again that there are social scientists who've studied the outbreaks of civil wars and state collapses over the past couple of decades. Part of what's going on is economics, namely that you're more likely to have civil wars and state collapses in poor countries than in rich countries, particularly in poor countries that have lots of unemployed young men. And the reason is pretty clear, that if you're poor, you don't have much to lose by starting a war, whereas if you're rich, you do have lots to lose. But there's another interesting thing that I would add there, which is something that I learned last week. There was a study carried out within the last year or so trying to identify what is the single most important factor predicting the collapse of a state, the collapse of government, as in Somalia, Afghanistan, etc., or the Congo. And the answer surprised me. Turns out that the best predictor is infant mortality. Countries with high infant mortality are the countries most likely to have a collapse of government. And high infant mortality is, I would think, simply an easily measured variable reflecting public health. This is to say that countries with poor public health get weakened because their trained workers live less long and are in the workforce for less long, and they've got more children per adult to support, and their workers spend more days per month at home in bed or with low efficiency. So that's why public health as well as economics has turned out one of the big predictors of social unrest.
Well, it makes AIDS a much more important disease, a political disease, and I must say, if it's true, it makes the African prospect a lot darker than we thought, no?
Everything's relative. Yes, the African prospect is very dark. The reason I say everything is relative is that there are other countries working hard at catching up with AIDS. Again, there was a newspaper account 2 weeks ago, widely diffused, of a very good study which was sponsored, I believe, by a branch of the CIA, which is interested in stability of countries. And this study examined what really is the prognosis for AIDS in the world today. Doctors tend to be conservative. They won't go out on a limb if the evidence isn't really strong. But if you have to make the best guess and you look at the numbers, that's to say the rate of acceleration of AIDS infections, five countries by the year 2010 are going to end up with enormous numbers of AIDS victims. And those five countries are China, India, Russia, Nigeria, and Ethiopia. Some of those countries, China particularly, to some extent India, are in a state of denial, and yet...
Are we just talking numbers of victims or percentages of the population? With China, anything is a big number.
Both.
Wow.
The numbers of victims, certainly, because these are big populations, but at the rate of acceleration, the number of victims is going to be... It's not going to be within the present decade 40% of adult men in China, as in the case of some of the worst afflicted countries of Africa. But that's a matter of time, and I would say it's a matter of whether the Chinese government gets scared enough to take the risk seriously.
Wow.
But again, AIDS is just one disease. Right. There are other diseases to worry about.
Jared, I want to come back to this question of race and culture and religion and then politics as a handle on the division in the world, because it comes up in conversation, you know, with intelligent people that part of this whole confrontation with the rest, and specifically the Islamic world, is that their societies and ours have been selecting out different qualities. And it gets to be a sort of a caricature, but they select for religious fanaticism, fundamentalism, certain kind of authoritarianism. And of course, we select for democracy and intelligence and progress, as if, even if the stereotypes were true, these arrangements of our lives could have a biological effect over a short term. Is it possible or not? I mean, I guess the real question is there any biological factor in this confrontation that we're sort of living through at the moment?
In one word, no. the image of Islam that you've explained there, it's an image that many people have, and it's an unfair image of Islam, just as to contrast it with a wonderful image of the West and the Judeo-Christian tradition would be unfair. I've done a lot of my work, field work, over the last 25 years in the world's largest Muslim country. And that is Indonesia, with 200 million inhabitants, the vast majority of whom are Muslim. And Indonesia is not at all a fanatical society. It has not had religious fanaticism. Indonesia has been remarkably tolerant of other religions. It's been remarkably progressive as regards family planning. Again, looking at the Muslim world historically, there were periods in the Middle Ages where the Islamic world was far ahead of the Christian world in knowledge and in literature and in technology. Again, the Judeo-Christian world is not this monolith of enlightenment and democracy. One doesn't have to go very far to find a retrograde Judeo-Christian countries. And in fact, within the United States, one does not have to go very far to find religious zealots, just as you can find religious zealots in Islamic countries. So there surely is no biological basis for a difference between Islam and Christianity, simply because there isn't any average difference between Islamic people and Christians.
So what is the reality, as you see it, of these gaps between the West and Islam, say, it's not the only division in the world, but on, say, modernization, secularism, warfare, visions of the future, values? What is the underlying truth? Or are these kind of media illusions? Or what's the truth of them, the differences?
There are big differences around the world, and we would be doing ourselves a disservice if we emphasized the differences between the Christian first world and the Islamic third world, because there are lots of other countries that present problems and issues similar to those of the Islamic third world. For Americans, the important question today is, what do we want to do about it? In the United States, we've had a long tradition of isolationism, and there are geographic reasons for that, that the United States is separated by oceans from Asia and Europe. We've been by far the most powerful country in the Western Hemisphere. And so the fact is that until relatively recently, we could afford to be isolationist. We were not so much affected by what happened overseas. World War II was a jolt to us, to our thinking. In that respect. And September 11th was another big jolt to our thinking. It's now clear that anybody anywhere in the world, including in the poorest, most backwards countries, has the potential for doing us harm by sending terrorists or diseases or, in the most simple case, illegal immigrants in large numbers that we can't stop. So what do we want to do about it? If we wanted to be selfless and noble, we could say, well, for charitable reasons, for reasons of humanity, we feel an obligation to help people elsewhere in the world. But if one doesn't want to be selfless and noble, and if you simply want to say, what is important for America's interests? Now what's important for America's interests is to cease being, to disabuse ourselves of the idea that we can get away with isolationism, and to recognize that our happiness depends upon the happiness of the rest of the world, and that therefore it's a good investment, in fact it's a life-saving investment on our part, to invest in the stability and progress and happiness of other countries. So I see foreign aid no longer as this noble thing that we do as an act of charity, but as self-preservation on our own part.
I wish you'd interpret the Bush Doctrine, sort of we're number one forever, that we won't let anyone catch up with us, and that we'll intervene with friends if we can, but on our own if we have to make sure that people more or less accept that rule.
Well, in commenting on it, because I'm not familiar with exactly, in the words of President Bush, what is the Bush doctrine. I don't want to pin on him things that he may not have said himself. I would, however, tease out some elements from what you just said. Are we number one? The fact is that the United States is the most powerful country in the world today. Fact. Are we number one forever? Nobody can predict it, but all the odds, 99 to 1, are against it, because over the last 13,000 years, countries have pulled ahead and fell behind. As of 8500 BC, Iraq led the world, and Iraq led the world between 8500 BC until at least 2500 BC. Mm-hmm. Iraq led the world in technology, use of metals, political organization, agricultural productivity, but Iraq no longer leads the world today. And there was a time when Britain, in the last century, led the world. And there was a time from around the time of Christ until the early Middle Ages, until 1300 or 1400, when China led the world. So based on history, we have to anticipate that the United States is not going to lead the world forever, but will undoubtedly be powerful for some time to come.
What's the biggest risk to us, and who's the up-and-comer here?
Oh, the biggest risk to us, I think, is not being overtaken by Paraguay or Japan, but the biggest risk is of world-scale instability, either through terrorism, the thing we most focus on, or diseases, the thing we next most focus on, but through environmental problems, the things that we least focus on, but that are the most insidious.
I wish you'd, you know, again, in the context of 13,000 years, interpret the general notion that, and a popular one in this country, that democracy and capitalism are so clearly fairer than other ways and more productive that they should be offered or sold or maybe even imposed on the rest of the world.
Well, imposing them on the rest of the world, we don't have the choice, because we are not the ones who make the decision. Quite apart from any moral arguments about whether we can impose democracy, we're simply not in a position to do it. There have been isolated cases, for example, our occupation of Japan after the Second World War, where we've done a good deal to impose democracy, but we can't impose it on the whole world. As for whether democracy is the best form of government, there are long-standing debates about it. I'm reminded of the expression, the joke by Winston Churchill. Someone pointed out to him all the terrible things about democracy, paralysis, the wrong people coming to the top, and Winston Churchill said something like, I acknowledge your points, yes, democracy really is the worst form of government, except for all the alternatives. And yes, there's something to that. I think I would argue that on the average, in the long run, democracy is the best form of government, because for many reasons, when those in power start making mistakes, there's a possibility of voting them out of power. Those in power know that there are others looking over their shoulders, and so they can't get away with much as they can in other societies. In a democracy, you're not likely to have as much government theft of private property, but all economists tell us that one of the best predictors of growth of economies is protection of private property rights, and that's something that you're more likely to get, much more likely to get in a democracy than in a dictatorship. So I would agree that in the long run, democracy is the best form of government, but there are plenty of aberrations, and there have been plenty of lousy democracies. We don't have to mention any names, and there have also been some terrific dictatorships. We don't have to mention names.
Jared Diamond, I'm just wondering, out of your rather remarkable knowledge of geography and ecology and terrain, landscape, and how these things affect development, wealth, stability, etc., I wonder if you have recipes to suggest for today's world as to development, recipes that might well be different from the World Bank's ideas or other conventional wisdom about how poor countries might do better. I'm just struck, for example, Jeffrey Sachs, very sophisticated economist, told us that when he first went to Bolivia in the mid-1980s to doctor their economy, and he did get good results eventually, but it never occurred to him as an economist that the high plateau in a great deal of Bolivia might have something to do with the way their markets and their economy worked. You've known all about that for 13,000 years. What advice have you got for countries trying to get ahead in the world?
I would have three pieces of advice. I would have three recipes for countries that want to get ahead. The emphasis in foreign aid, in the World Bank and other such institutions in the past has been on what are called good institutions. That's to say, what counts, they think, is human institutions. And if you can get those countries overseas to have free flow of capital and free foreign exchange and good laws and protection of private property rights, that's what's required to make Paraguay and the Congo rich. There are three things wrong with this, and those are Jared Diamond's three recipes for how to make Paraguay rich. One is public health. I mentioned before that a big drag on the economies of poor countries around the world tends to be public health issues, that their workers die early and are sick often and are supporting lots of children. So investments in public health have an enormous payoff and are relatively cheap. And this is not an untried experiment. The proof is that those tigers of Asia, those countries that have achieved the most spectacular economic gain in the last several of decades, namely Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, and Mauritius, they're all countries that made big investments in public health because they saw that it was in their economic interest. So that's one thing.
So did Cuba, incidentally, without you know, spectacular economic results.
That's right. Cuba also invested heavily in public health, and reasons why they did not achieve spectacular economic results is that they had other things going against them, including obstacles of foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So I would not take Cuba's public health investment as evidence that public health doesn't work. It doesn't work if there are enormous other things against you.
Okay.
First recipe, then, is public health. Second recipe is the environment. The biggest risk to society over the next several decades will be environmental risks, and there's a long list of them. And lenders have tended to overlook environmental issues. The result is that many lenders have ended up doing more harm than good. So my second recipe is to take environmental problems much more seriously. The main message in this area is that it turns out to be, in the long run, much cheaper to avoid making environmental problems than to let them develop and then have to spend billions of dollars trying to solve them through technology. And then the third thing that I would say is that you can't just go plunk down good institutions anywhere in the world. You can't just tell people in the Congo and Paraguay and Nepal to pass some good laws and expect it to work. There's been a long connection over the last 13,000 years between the conditions for complex human institutions, the social and educational conditions, and those institutions themselves. I was having an interesting phone conversation this morning with an economist at Brown called Lewis Putterman, who, with colleagues, has a recent very interesting paper on connections between history and wealth in the modern world. And he was explaining to me that in order to help poor countries become rich fast, we've got to understand those connections in the past. And those historical connections have practical significance. So, in short, my recipe to the World Bank and foreign aid agencies is think of public health, the environment, and historical connections.
Jared Diamond, this is fascinating, and an hour isn't long enough. As I was rereading your book, though, I was imagining your son rewriting it in 50 years or redoing it to encompass everything that'll have happened by then. What's the title going to be? Guns, Germs, Steel, and blank to get us through 2050.
If there's a world, if in 50 years from now there's a civilized world in which my sons are still sitting down writing, the title of the book that they would write is We Made It. Namely, we solved the problems that 50 years ago in the year 2002, my father was unsure whether we would solve. On the other hand, if in the year 2052 my sons can't write such a book because the world has collapsed, then someone writing a manuscript on papyrus because there won't be any books will say we failed.